John knew that his end was coming. He had been arrested and summarily thrown in prison by Herod Antipas. You see, John, never one to shy away from decrying iniquity, had simply but loudly said what many others were thinking, that this marriage of that fox, Herod, to Herodias was an outrage. No matter how powerful you are, taking your brother's wife while your brother is still alive to be your own while you are already married, even if it is a political marriage, that just isn't right. Now, those probably weren't the only words that landed John the Baptist behind bars, but they were some of the most scandalous. And as we all know, scandal sells. And Herod, as the Roman authority in the Galilee, did what many with authority do when confronted by a troublemaking agitator who is telling the truth. You put them in a place where they can do you no more harm. Behind gates, walls, guards, and bars. Out of sight, out of mind. And so John waited, morning by morning, day by day, night by night. He paced the dank confines that would keep him the rest of his life, cut off from his friends and followers by the very powers they had been fighting. Sure, he raged. This was the man that ranted in the desert about this brood of vipers. But that rage can last only so long. And in time, solitude swallows even the purest of rage. And then come the questions. Had it been worth it? Was this all for naught? Will this foreign occupation ever end? When will we reclaim this sacred land? Who is carrying on the work? What is Jesus doing? And then, as happens in jails around the world in almost any time and place, word from the outside began to filter back inside. And the word that came back must have been unsettling for John. At least it was for John's disciples. Because even if some of John's same words were being said by Jesus, they were being backed up by a very different set of deeds. The incredible reports, incredible as in cannot be believed, are passed down the line. Teachings about the love of one's enemy. Enough feasting for Jesus to be called a glutton and a drunkard. Consorting with agents of the empire. Could these be the act of the Messiah? What in the name of the Holy One is he doing? All of my work for this? Ask him, John tells his disciple, ask him, for I must know. Is he the one who is to come? Or are we to wait for another? I must say, given the forceful proclamations that we often associate with John as we encounter him in the wilderness, locusts and wild honey, camel skins for clothes, last week his winnowing fork in hand. Questioning and doubt are not two of the attributes that first come to mind when thinking of John the Baptist. And there are those scholars who read this passage and say that John had no doubt, that actually he asked this question so that his disciples would be able to release John's guidance and follow Jesus after the Baptist's impending death. Which frankly sounds a little too pat to me, devoid of much feeling or depth of emotion. John was imprisoned, facing a sure death, and was unable to see and hear what this Jesus was doing, and was desperately not wanting his last gasps to be fruitless. He too faced the world in its pain and in its inequity and asked, "Are you the one?" And we, like scores of generations before us, will not be there to see Jesus touch someone and then watch them walk or see again. Or bless a couple of fish and some bread and have it feed thousands. Or calm a storm with a word. Often we, like John, are left to wonder, are you the one? Maybe that's why 1 week later it's a little easier to be with John now. For here he's not as sure. Here he's not as certain. But here he is no less faithful. Still wanting to know where to look, how to know. The answer that Jesus gives, of course, isn't really an answer. I mean, does he ever give a straight answer? His response comes in the form of a list of his greatest hits. The lame walk, the blind see, the deaf hear. All good, and as we heard in our conveniently chosen passage from Isaiah this morning, very Messiah-like. Except that this wasn't the only version of a Messiah that the people of Israel were expecting. In fact, some thought a prophet along the lines of St. John the Baptist, an ascetic who knew about justice, that would be the chosen one. Others were waiting for one who would lead the rebellion and force Rome out and return the land to God's chosen people. So John was not alone in his doubt. And yet Jesus, clear in purpose, simply offered John's disciples his understanding of what God's reign was about, as witnessed in his actions. "Now do you see what I see?" he says. Last week, our preacher Andy Schammel preached a fiery sermon about what John the Baptist, about what John the Baptist was proclaiming down by the Jordan River. And some of what Andy explored was how Jesus dealt with the expectations that came to him around authority and power, empire and domination. And this week, a similar message can be heard, but we need to filter out the background noise in order to make out the words. Because after Jesus has offered his answer to John's disciples, he then turns his attention to the gathered crowd, many of who are aware of John and likely had gone down to the river themselves to hear and repent, to be baptized and be changed. And so with John's question about whether or not Jesus is the one still hanging in the air, to those gathered, Jesus offers these enigmatic questions about their own expectations. "What did you go out into the wilderness to look at? A reed shaken by the wind? What then did you go out to see? Someone dressed in soft robes? Look, those who wear soft robes are in royal palaces. What then did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I tell you, and more than a prophet. A reed shaken by the wind, soft robes, what is this Jesus getting at? Well, I believe this wise and innocent Jesus is doing just what he was doing with John's disciples, but given a different audience, is using a different frame. Now, this may be simply an amazing coincidence, but of the royal figures of that day, those in the power of the Roman Empire, those who had control over the population of Judea and parts surrounding, those who ruled from palaces wearing soft robes, there was one in particular who had a coin minted with his own face on the front, and on the back of the coin was the image of a reed blown over by the wind. That of Herod Antipas, John the Baptist's jailer. An amazing coincidence. Is this what you went into the wilderness looking for? Jesus asks. Ruthless power, self-centered ambition, power shown through force? No, that's not what you were looking for then. That's not what you're looking for now, Jesus says. You're looking for a king, but not that kind of king. Once again, Jesus offers a startling glimpse of God's kingdom, God's reign, by using a coin of this realm. And once more, Jesus is reframing expectations, something that he does throughout the Gospels, and I might add, with very good reason. Because so often, even with the space of 2,000 years as perspective, we, like John and myriad others, come to Jesus with our own understanding of what this one should be like. Now, for us, it may not be for the overthrow of the empire. For us, we may be seeking the empire's maintenance. Or maybe its return to its rightful glory. Or maybe we are seeking the divine stamp of approval on a burning issue of our day. There are any number of ways we can turn Jesus into what we most want him to be, a kinder, gentler version of us. And then we find it difficult to see Jesus in the world around us. And to John, to the crowds, to the disciples, to the Pharisees, to the Romans, to all of us, Jesus asks, "Do you see what I see? Where are you looking?" To those with ears, listen. To those with eyes, look. The blind receive their sight. The lame walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have good news brought to them. This is what the Anointed One does. This is where the kingdom breaks in. And friends, this is why at this time of Advent, this time of preparation and anticipation, why this time is so critical. Not because it takes that long just to sort out the dang Christmas lights, but because every year, for much of the time, we are looking in the wrong places. Our attention is diverted, bifurcated, distorted, unfocused. And as we approach this tremendous mystery, in our fear, we often sentimentalize what lies before us, attempting to skirt by on the edges with inflatable lawn ornaments and gift cards and holiday cheer. And we wonder why many of us, at the most wonderful time of the year, why we feel that empty ache within us. Why, sometimes in desperation, we turn to alcohol and other drugs, seeking ways to numb us from this void. And today, though trapped in our lives of consumption and absorption, we stumble, and none too late, on this passage of John trapped in prison. And we hear Jesus ask John, ask us, where are we looking for the Emmanuel, the chosen one, for God dwelling among us? Where indeed? Where in your life? Where in the lives of those around you do you see healing and new life? Where in your life, where in the lives of those around you do you see people receiving love where it is least expected or even warranted? Where in your life, where in the lives of those around you, do you see people returning to wholeness and giving thanks? Friends, in these upcoming weeks, days, as we approach the manger once more, look among us now for the work of the one who is to come, and take note. What you will see will not show false hope or naive optimism. What you will see will be a light that shines in the darkness, that the darkness does not overcome it. It will be there. Listen and look.